This is Sphinx Radio, exploring the enigmas of the ages and the puzzles of the present, with your host, William H. Kennedy.
Hello, Carlo. Welcome to Sphinx Radio.
Nice to be here.
You're coming out with a new book on the priest pedophile crisis. Could you tell us the title, please?
Yeah, the title of the book is Predators and Prayers. It's being published by Dorchester Publishing.
Dorchester.
It'll be in bookstore August 1st.
August the 1st, 2005. And by the time people hear this, it will already be in bookstores. But you can also get information about it on your website. That's philipcarlo.com. Is that correct?
Yes.
Philip Carlo, Philip with one L. .com.
One L.
Okay, that's right. And could you give us a breakdown of the book?
You know, Bill, this is like a long, involved, bumpy road. If I may, I'll briefly try to make it short. I wrote a book. I started researching it and writing it in 1983, which is a long time ago. It was essentially an honest, very gripping, what I call faction, a fusion of faction and fiction about what is happening to missing children, how they're being used and abused in pornography by groups of pedophiles around the world. I wrote this book basically because I just saw this as a really gripping subject, very, very intense, something that once the reader it gets involved with it, you really can't put it down. Essentially, it was about the abduction of an 8-year-old girl while she was in Europe with her mother on vacation, and pictures of this child end up in a pornographic magazine published out of Amsterdam called Lolita. The family gets the hold of this magazine and they hire a private detective, and thus we enter the world of what these people did. And really all I was doing, I thought, was writing a novel, just a gripping tale about an abducted child. I did do a lot of research. I spent about a year going all over Europe in brothels for children, talking to the people who are making these productions, child porn. And when the book came out, well, first I should say the book was turned down by 10 publishers when I got back to New York, and then finally we sold it to E.P. Dutton, which was a good house, and Simon & Schuster ended up publishing in mass market. But what happened briefly when the book came out was, it was like a firestorm. I opened the Pandora's box. I ended up doing an incredible amount of media. I was on like Geraldo like 35 times. I was on Donahue 3 times. I was all over the place, and I started meeting more and more people in law enforcement, and I was invited to speak at Scotland Yard. I was invited to speak at a symposium for Interpol and different symposiums on child sexual abuse around the world. I spoke at 5 different symposiums that were mainly filled with doctors and people in law enforcement. The more I spoke, the more people I met, the more I networked in this field, for want of a better word. And I became, suddenly I was a child advocate. I was speaking on behalf of sexually abused children. And I became very, very involved in these issues. It's hard not to when you understand the truth behind how terribly children are used at the hands of sexual predators. Interestingly, I ended up selling this book to Robert De Niro to make into a feature film, which hasn't happened to date, but perhaps it will. In any event, it was a nice experience meeting him, going to Europe with him, him seeing all these things, and me sharing what I learned about these underground networks of sexual predators. Forgive me for telling this long story, but it segues into how I got involved in this.
Now, keep going. It's very interesting.
Well, what happened was when in the mid '80s and in the early '90s, when the scandals involving priests was beginning to come to the surface, I started snooping around and asking questions and speaking to victims, and I was absolutely appalled. That word does not quite describe how I felt when I realized the church was not only allowing child molesters into their ranks, but they were protecting them, coddling them, giving them free legal counsel, clothing, giving them clothes, giving them food, shelter, and wine. And I, you know, for not knowing how to express the anger I felt, the outrage I felt, I wrote a play. You know, this thing about the pen being mightier than the sword, sometimes it can really be true. I wrote a play called Swear on God You Won't Tell, which is what I heard priests were telling children right before they were abused. They were having children swear to God, usually with the specter of an altar behind them, the crucifixion, confessionals, all the trappings of the church, of high spirituality, were used as mechanisms, as tools for these. Well, I was always, you know, I almost started cursing, but I don't want to do that. Well, let's say, for want of these child molesters, these perverts, these sexual degenerate scumbags, use the church as a means to get free access to trusting children. Your viewers, your listeners must understand, we're talking here about pedophiles, and pedophiles seek out prepubescent children. They're not interested in teenagers, they're interested in prepubescent children. And so we're talking 4 and 5 and 6 and 7. I wrote this play, it was received very well, but it was dark. I mean, it was really dark, but it was the truth about what's going on. And I had in my head to write a book about this subject, and I ended up getting involved in other projects, and I wrote a book about a serial killer called Richard Ramirez, The Night Stalker. We actually did a show,
right,
you and
sure,
I recently
that was
on that.
Show, yeah.
Well, what I was trying to do was write a story indicating how a severely abused child, whether it's sexual or physical or psychological, can grow up deformed and become antisocial and become a psychopath. And once they reach that threshold, they become very dangerous to society. And so that was my initial interest in this world of serial murder and murderers. And I kind of got sidetracked from the church. But the scandals, the more information kept coming down the tubes, more scandals, and it got darker and uglier and more contrived. And I realized there was a true criminal conspiracy by the church hierarchy to hide these people, to hide what they were doing.
So it's a top-level problem.
Oh, absolutely. It began from the Pope, the people that surround him in the Vatican, on down. It's a pyramid. And the people at the top of the pyramid absolutely controlled what the cardinals and the bishops did. Essentially, they viewed it as just an embarrassment to the church. That's all it was. Cover it up, hush it up, move the priest to another parish, and that's what they did. We have documented cases, hundreds of them. I'm sure there are thousands, because there's so many that we don't know about, but we know about hundreds of them where predator priests were moved to 20, 30 parishes. Paul Shanley, recently convicted of child molestation in the Massachusetts court, 74 years old, he was moved to 29 parishes.
29.
One of the reasons they were able to prosecute Shanley was because he was out of Boston for many of those years, so the clock stopped after 7 years, child molesters don't have to worry anymore. There's a statute of limitations. One of the things we're trying to do with this book is to change that. If you murder somebody, you can be held responsible forever, for your entire life.
Right, there's no statute of limitations.
There's no statute of limitations for murder. Damn, it should be that way with rape. It should that if a man rapes a child, there is no way he should be able to get away with that just because a little time passed. In other words, if it's 6.5 years, we can prosecute you. If it's 6 months later and it's 7 years and a day, we can't prosecute you. That is bullshit. And that the church used very, very cleverly, I might add, to not be prosecuted. What I'm trying to do with the publication of this book, if I may jump ahead,
sure,
is try to get this done away with, and also to try to bring the RICO statutes in play, because what essentially we have here is cardinals and bishops conspiring to hide child molesters. Child rape is a very serious felony. The way they use the RICO statute against the mafia, they should be using that against the Catholic Church.
And that's because that goes against organizations which do crimes, the RICO statute, right?
Right. And this is an organization that is doing a crime, protecting, coddling, and hiding child molesters.
And encouraging them to join.
Well, the truth of the matter is this. Once child molesters essentially have no life other than molesting children. Their sunrise and their sunset is the sexual abuse of children. I know that. That is an absolute fact. When these people realize that they would be protected by the church and they have free access to trusting children, and they would have the guise of a priest with a crucifix around their neck, with a church standing behind them, can you imagine a child seeing a guy take the pulpit on Sunday and speak morally and ethically and really seem holier than thou, and behind him is the crucifixion, and he's giving communion, and the bells are ringing, and the incense is in the air. This child feels that is God. That priest is God, of course. He's, at the very least, he's God's right-hand person.
Very close to God, if not God, yeah.
Exactly. But the way a six-year-old or a seven-year-old perceives that individual, looking up to that individual, it's a giant. And then he's dressed in his Sunday fancy outfit, and he's got this fancy hat, and everyone bows their head to him. A child is very vulnerable to an individual like that, and they knew it. And they used it like an insidious scalpel. They cut these children, and they hurt them for their lives. These children grow up dysfunctional. They grow up with all kinds of sexual problems. They grow up to become alcoholics. They grow up to become abusers of drugs. A lot of, not all of them certainly, but many of them have problems that last for the rest of their life, because it wasn't just abuse. The abuse alone is bad enough, but when it's all wrapped around the guise of a church, and it's a church representative, an agent of God, it has a very, very devastating effect on a child. Children have no point of reference other than what's in front of them. They have no experience to look back on. They have nothing but what's in front of them. And when that happened and that occurred and they were warned, don't tell your family, don't tell your mother, don't tell your father. If you do, you'll burn in hell. If you do, you'll never go to heaven. Think about the devastating effect that can have on an innocent child. And it did, and it does, and it still is, in fact. Of all the things I wrote about in my career, and I've written a lot about crime and criminals, nobody gets my goat more than these people, because they absolutely were able to camouflage themselves. It's truly a wolf in sheep's clothing. But this wolf is not interested in eating, he's interested in molesting. And the church protected these bastards. And so, I don't know, it was about 2001, I decided to finally write a book on this, and I had all my research done. I had spoken to lawyers that represented the victims. I spoken to victims. I spoke to a molester, even, and I moved to Rome, and I took an apartment 2 blocks from the Vatican. And I sat down every day, 5 or 6 hours a day, and I wrote this blistering frontal assault on the church. Mind you, I was not a victim. I have no axe to grind other than this is a terrible injustice. You people are responsible, and I'm going to say that in this book. Because I was writing it as fiction, I was able to pretty much just go wherever I want. I stayed always within the confines of reality. Everything I wrote in this book is based on the truth. I'll give you a couple examples of that. But, I every day I would see the Vatican, and every day I saw it, I got madder and madder and angrier, because I felt these people who present themselves as the most righteous, most religious, most God-fearing people in the world, you bend down, you get down on your knees when you see us.
Right.
They were bastards. They were criminals. I didn't plan to say this, and I don't even know if I should say it, but I'm going to say it. some nights when I was coming back from dinner, I was so angry, I would go and I'd piss on the Vatican. I'd walk up to the wall and I'd just do it.
Really?
You know, I had no way of expressing my anger better than that. You know, and, you know, maybe it was wrong, maybe I shouldn't have done that, but I did do it, and I'm not really ashamed that I did it. And if I had to do it over again, I would do it over again. I mean, I'm supposed to be a writer, you know, and have some decorum and some literary stature about me, but at some point in time, you just want to spit in the bastard's eyes.
You can't get away from the human element in any of this. You can't be
neutral.
Well, yeah.
No, you know, and I interviewed an individual who absolutely was abused. He was severely abused. He's one of the leading spokespeople out of the Boston group that had been abused. And he committed suicide last year. He killed himself.
Oh, yeah, I know who you mean. Yeah.
Patrick. Yeah.
Patrick McSorley, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right, very, very nice boy, sweet boy, and he was dead at 29 because it was essentially the curse that these people put on them. So, you know, I wrote this book, and I a couple of publicists, again, the same, went through the same thing I went with Stolen Flower. You know, it's really a good read. You can't put the book down, but we don't want to insult the church. We don't. And then finally, Dorchester had the balls to buy the book and publish the book, and it's coming out in August, and I feel great about it, and I can't wait to get out there and tell what I know and point the finger where it deserves to be pointed.
Are you planning a book tour of any sort?
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
And I'll be all over television, and I'll be on CNN and telling what I know, and I know a lot. You know, I've truly been involved in this issue for about 20 years and focusing specifically and particularly on the church's criminal behavior for the last, maybe, I don't know, 12 or 13 years. And I'm very proud of this. I really feel that people in the arts should devote themselves to trying to create stories and books, movies that have a point of view, that tell something, that expose something, that shine light on something black and dark. It should always be entertaining, though. That's the problem, you know. You know, it's not as though I'm a social do-gooder. That has really nothing to do with what I am. I'm a writer. I see something that's an injustice, and I'm trying to air it out, get light on it.
And sometimes, you know, like when you do it in fiction, you can bring it much more alive than just a standard like what I do. I do who, what, where, when, and why. But when you add the element of fiction into hard fact, you really get the point home.
Well, you know, I'm not comparing myself to him, but one of the greatest writers that ever lived, John Steinbeck, he wrote a book called The Grapes of Wrath.
Sure, right.
Which was essentially an expose of how migrant workers were being exploited. And Mr. Steinbeck, he spent a year with migrant workers. He lived with them. He spoke to them. He saw their pain. He saw their suffering. And he went off and wrote a novel. He didn't write a true account of what he saw. He wrote a novel that was able to encompass all the pain, all the suffering, all the indiscriminate brutality that was the bosses were subjecting good American people to. And it absolutely changed the way migrant workers were treated. So I've always felt, since, like, when I, you know, in the movie, when Henry Fonda makes that speech at the end of the film, I don't know if you remember it.
Sure, yeah.
And the mother asked, yeah, she asked him, where will you be? How can I find you? And he says, you know, anytime there's people suffering, you'll find me. Anytime that you'll find me. And I was a kid when I saw that. But that, it just hit me right in the heart, you know.
Sure.
And I mean, even now I'm starting to get emotional about it. And later on, when I became, you know, when I knew the direction that I was going to take in life, and it was writing, and I was going to commit myself to writing, I always remembered that, and I always tried to do that. Even my first book, Stolen Flower, it was essentially an expose about what happens to abducted children. And now I'm trying to do that. I'm not trying to do it. I am doing it with the church. I mean, I plan to have a big, I am Catholic. I was born brought up a Catholic, and I planned to have a big excommunication party. And Bill, I invite you to it. Right?
Oh, it sounds very, very good.
Yeah.
Do you think you'll get your yearly calendar and Christmas card from the Vatican next Christmas?
I don't think so.
You think you're off the Christmas card list, huh?
Yeah, and I hope I am. I aspire to be. You know, I mean, you couldn't get me to go inside of a church with a loaded gun to my head right now, because I see that church, unfortunately, is den of iniquities run by a bunch of perverted
thugs, basically. Yeah. Can I ask you, in your research?
But don't get me wrong, I like them.
Oh, you know, some of them are all right.
No, I'm just kidding. Yes, I'm sorry.
In your research, did you come along anything with the international transfer of priests and religious orders, like the Jesuits or the Dominicans or the Franciscans?
Actually, the people, those different groups don't seem, as far as I know, to be part and parcel of the ongoing problem with predator priests. The predator priests, child molesters joined the seminaries in mass when they realized they would be protected. I'm sure some of those filtered to those different factions, but for the most part, they just saturated the church. You know, Bernard Law, who was a cardinal of Boston,
sure,
he coddled molesters. In fact, he was the cardinal that Paul Stanley worked under, and you know, they shipped him off to Rome. He's in Rome right now. He's the cardinal of the church that's inside the Vatican. I mean, they gave him a place of honor.
They gave him a promotion, right?
They gave him a promotion.
He lives in a palace, yeah.
Right, exactly. He's treated like royalty.
He has the protection of the Swiss Guard.
Exactly. Yeah. He should be in jail for conspiring to protect child molesters, child rapists. And what the Vatican did was they promoted him. If that doesn't tell you all, if that doesn't spit in the face of every victim, not only in Boston, but across the country, you tell me what does.
Oh, I mean, it's absolutely atrocious. And there were actually spontaneous protests in Rome when Law first got there.
Yeah.
The people there heard about them. You know, they don't want them there anywhere more than we want them here.
No. In fact, there was such a hue and outcry in Boston about him, he was forced to leave. And we all thought he would be leaving the court. He would be thrown out of the church, essentially. He'd quietly be put out to pasture. Or contraire, my friend. What they did was they promoted him, they put him in charge of the church.
And he will be able to vote for the next pope.
He might very well be nominated for the next pope, based upon how these people treat child molesters.
Sure. I mean, they are the enablers of child molesters, and the child molesters themselves are generally given promotion. I mean, you don't hear a lot about it, but Bishop Thomas Dupre up here in Massachusetts, the Bishop of Springfield, he was forced to resign because he himself was a sexual abuser.
Absolutely. You know, what happened, to make a long story short, what happened was when pedophiles realized that they can join the church and be protected, they joined the church in mass. If you look at all the people, the men that are now going on trial and the men who have been accused, the ones of being forced out of the church, they're all in their late 60s and their 70s. So that automatically tells us they joined the church in the 60s and the 70s.
Right.
And that's what has happened. And once they knew that this was the case, they spoke amongst themselves, they speak amongst themselves, they network with each other. When I'm saying each other, I mean molesters. They all joined the church. And they moved up inside the church. Think about how many years they've been in the church. If they're in the 70s, it stands to reason that people in position of power inside the church are molesters.
Themselves.
They moved up absolutely. They moved up the church hierarchy, and they became bishops and cardinals, and that's who they are now.
I have one other question in all your research. Did you come across any ritualistic elements in any of this abuse? You didn't?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
You know, I did not. I wasn't looking for it. I didn't hear about that. I was focusing specifically on pedophiles and sexual predators. I don't know. I can't really speak honestly one way or another. And I'm the kind of type of guy that unless I know about something, I don't
talk about it.
Sure,
I mean, that's perfectly fine. And
yeah.
I never contended that if there were ritual elements that it was any worse than if there were not ritual elements. It's the sexual contact that's the horrible thing.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it's essentially child molesters who go to a seminar for a couple of months, are given a collar, and are given a parish, and they're given automatic respect. As soon as they walk on the scene, that you know, they're treated with a lot of respect. Yes, Father. I mean, look, you must call them Father in a respectful way. You must bow your head when they approach you. You have to treat them like they're holy. And then suddenly, what these priests are, what these fathers are, they are really child molesters. They are not priests at all. It is such a misnomer that essentially what's going on here is that these are bad priests that went, these are good priests that went bad, or these are priests that because they have vows of celibacy, they weren't allowed to have sex, so they became child molesters. That is bullshit. These are child molesters that became priests because they knew they would be protected, and they knew they had access to legions of trusting, malleable children.
And they also had access to find out who were from the dysfunctional families, who would
automatically
be able to tell, you know?
It's always, you know, it's a good point you make, Bill. That's a given. These guys look for that. They look for children who come from broken homes. They look for children that don't have fathers. They look for children who come from dysfunctional situations because they are the most vulnerable and they don't have anywhere to turn to. Often, however, when a child did tell their parents, or their mother, or their father, assuming it's a divorce situation, or it's just, for whatever reason, there's only one parent, and the parent complained to the church, what the church did all the time was send two priests to talk to them, to console them, to assure them that everything would be taken care of when these priests were, in fact, lawyers, who were priests, real priests, but they were also lawyers, and all they were doing was looking to protect the interests of the church. Never the child.
Never, ever.
They didn't give a flying you-know-what about the children. All they care was about protecting their own, protecting the church.
Even if it cost lots of money or whatever it took, huh?
Look, in Boston alone, they paid out $87 million. That's $87 million. And that's all money that should have gone to the needy, to help
those
that are in need, not to pay off for the sins of child molesters and the actions of child molesters. So far, the Catholic Church has paid out $857 million, almost $1 billion, and this summer, there's going to be a huge settlement in Los Angeles County.
Oh, that's a big one, yeah.
A big one. By far, many more victims.
They describe themselves as a nation.
The Boston Diocese, or Diocese, there we have another one of Bernard Law's cronies, Mahoney.
Right. Exactly.
And Mahoney is still arrogant and he's still with hubris, and he won't tell anybody about what priests were reported and what priests molested or secret information. He's not going to tell. Somebody should arrest this guy. Somebody should do something. How could he get away with it? How could he protect child molesters and get away with it?
And they do. Yep.
It's a travesty of justice. He's worse than Bernard Law ever was.
Oh, sure. I mean, anywhere he's gone, he, in fact, is someone who specialized in protecting pedophiles.
Exactly right. Exactly right. He was like a mafia hitman going after the people who were trying to let the truth be known, people who were trying to expose what was going on. All he was interested in was hushing it up. I believe he's a molester. You want to know the truth? You know, where there's smoke, there's fire. In good conscience, how can any man who is not a molester do nothing but protect molesters when they know for sure certain that the man is...
Oh. It's mind-boggling with Mahoney because he transferred people to the next diocese next door, Orange County.
Yeah.
I mean, they had a big game. They had the largest area they could get, you know.
Right. And recently, Orange County made a settlement for $102 million, and I understand the settlement in Los Angeles County is going to pale make that it's going to be much, much larger. That now they're already in discussions, and they're talking about $500 million, paying off victims $500 million. What did these people do? How did they do it? How were they able to get away with it?
It's unbelievable.
And why aren't people writing senators and congressmen and demanding?
Rioting in the streets, even.
The way they did in Boston, they demanded that Berlin Wall get the hell out of there, and they got him out. They got him out of Boston, but he's in the Vatican now. Isn't that amazing?
They promoted him out of the way.
Yeah, they made him. He was like a lieutenant, and they made him a general.
Right, that's what it boils down to. Yeah. Well, Philip, let's get your webpage address one more time.
I'm at www.philipcarlo.com. My book is Predators and Prayers, Dorchester Publishing. It'll be out August 1. And I thanks so much, Bill, for giving me voice.
No problem, and we'll definitely have you back on Sphinx Radio.
Look forward to that.